Frankie, are you okay? Have you recovered from reading the wrong Investor Group on Climate Change report for the podcast this week?
I just really didn't need to do that this week, you know? Like, it was just all the f***ing weeks.
Yes, I know. I know. As I said, I just felt bad for you because I know how just completely f***ed off I would feel if I had to read an extra paper that I didn't need to read. For a phantom podcast that would never exist.
For once, I was feeling so organized. Like, I got onto it much earlier than I normally would have.
I think it's Irwin's fault because he's far too prolific.
Yeah, I'm going to blame him. God, Irwin, stop publishing papers every other week. I can't keep up. Can we talk about the latest IGCC paper? It should be bloody obvious which one we mean.
And then I was thinking, oh, we can't do two IGCC papers in a row, really.
It's IGCC month. Let me sum up.
This is Let Me Sum Up, your regular deep dive into recent reports on climate and energy. I'm Luke Menzel, recording today on Wurundjeri land, and as always, I'm joined by my two co-hosts. Global Vice President for Marketing and Extortion at the Let Me Sum Up podcast, Frankie Muscovich. Hello, Frankie.
Good evening, Luke and Tennant. Here with you on Gadigal country.
And a man who spends his spare time reflecting on whether we haven't found alien civilizations because they have effectively decoupled economic growth from an ever-increasing demand for energy, Tennant Reid. G'day, Tennant.
Hello. That's a very optimistic solution to the Fermi paradox, and I think my favourite.
On this week's show, we dig into a new report from the Investor Group on Climate Change that looks at best practices for driving investment in innovative climate solutions. But first, we are recording the day before the federal budget this week, so rather than wildly speculating on what energy and climate goodies may lay therein, let's talk about something we do know about. Last week's announcement that the Albanese government will establish a new national net zero authority. The new authority is being tasked with supporting workers and communities through the transition to a net zero economy, particularly in areas that have a lot of industry built around fossil fuels. All in all, pretty exciting.
And a good idea. As always, nothing is such a good idea that you can't mess it up in practice. But the idea that there's both good news stories and bad news stories associated with energy transition and transition to net zero, and that you need to get on top of the potential disruptions and negative effects on communities that and workers and supply chains that are currently built up around fossil fuel production or use or export, and be ready for the change that is going to come as Australia does what it's committed to and other nations do what they've committed to, and demand for a bunch of these products goes way down, like getting ready for that is very sensible. So good on the government for committing to do something sensible. The logistics of this net zero authority are going to be finalised by an agency established within Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet. And there will in time be legislation to establish this authority, and as we understand it, a board or a governance structure that gives a voice to employees and employers and the community. So there's a lot left to be done, but given that we've got a whole bunch of closures just of coal-fired electricity generation happening over the coming decade, like that's plenty to get ready for. I don't think the government is super enthusiastic about talking about the next stage of things, but as and when demand for coal and gas internationally takes a dive, there's going to be a lot more to get ready for.
The framing, the name for this new body, the Net Zero Authority, it sort of implies a much bigger and all-encompassing task than the one that it actually has. The actual job that it's been given is much more akin to a, you know, what many would call a just transition authority, sort of supporting communities that have been reliant on carbon-intensive industries. But I guess the government was more comfortable steering clear of that particular framing and opted for something a bit more general. And it made me wonder whether there was an implication that more jobs could be given to this body over time. There's certainly a lot more to do. But we've also got, you know, various bodies and institutions springing up.
Like wildflowers after the rains that end a drought.
I think this is addressing a part of the landscape that's been absent at this level of government and governance, right? It's really important. A lot of stakeholder groups across the economy have been calling for a focus on a just transition. And whilst we've seen this government very active in seeking to implement a lot of their election commitments, there's not a policy framework yet committed to that sort of really hones in on what's needed for a just transition. Again, it's one of those things you'd expect to see addressed as part of that broader economy-wide approach to net zero. So, I mean, I think the more time goes on, the less tenable it is not to have something, and indeed I think it's smart to agree that you need all those parties around the table to be looking at this. So for mine, it feels like a really positive step in the right direction, and I would hope and expect to see its mandate updated and reviewed over time, like a noting tenant that the energy transition's the one that's most immediate and perhaps impacting communities across the country, but there will be others in due course.
So thinking about the many, many jobs that the many, many pieces of work that there are to be done in the net zero transition. We've got, you know, the Climate Change Authority in charge of the how's policy doing and how's our total response to climate change going. We've got this Net Zero Authority in charge of the how are we connecting things up so that intensely affected by economic transition communities aren't left behind. Thinking about the how do we achieve the mega clean exports type ambitions that are out there, the superpower vision or the hydrogen vision or whatever, whose job should that be? Because there's a lot of work involved in, for instance, the social license and planning and the workforce development and on and on and on. As of today, is anybody in charge of that? And if should anybody be in charge of that? Or is that such a big story that it actually needs cooperation rather than a czar somewhere?
So I think there's actually a bit of connective tissue between this conversation that you're raising, Tennant, and the paper that we're about to discuss.
You're disciplining us. You're keeping us to time or a facsimile of it.
Because
guesses.
One of the recommendations of the IGCC's report that we're about to discuss is the need for a industrial development policy which can coordinate the many and various activities that need to come together to see Australian industry make the transition and grasp the opportunities of a clean economy. So I feel a little bit cautious about opining on exactly what new institutions may be needed to drive such an agenda before the agenda itself is defined. I feel like understanding what we're trying to achieve, at least at a strategic level, and then considering the various bodies and functions that we have and where they need to be augmented might be a pretty good place to start. But I think it's entirely plausible that the remit of current bodies may need to be significantly expanded, and indeed new bodies may need to be created. The one thing I'd say is that there's a strong bias in existing institutions towards the energy side of the ledger, and particularly the supply side of the energy side of the ledger. And I think that a much more holistic approach is going to be needed before too very long.
Agree with that. So far, this net zero authority is just an announcement, but if there is an opportunity in setting up institutions like this, where we know those challenges around transition won't just exist in one or two industries, but we are or will be needing to think much more broadly across the economy, it'd be nice to see that acknowledged from the outset. Because I do think there is a risk at entrenching some of the bias that has gone into some of the institutions we've already got. We've seen that a little bit in the various reviews of ARENA and the CEFC, like how their mandates need to be looked at and updated over time. So trying to keep a broad focus, understanding the breadth of the challenge ahead is a good principle.
Shall we chat about a report that encourages us to do just that?
Or shall we talk about our impending T-shirt empire?
What?
Yes. In the realm of priority setting, clearly we are the models that any net zero planning authority should follow. Let's indeed follow the butterfly of T-shirts over the field of this podcast.
Oh, dear me. Okay.
Which one of you wants to set it up? And then I'm happy to talk about the due diligence that I've embarked upon.
Set it up. We're a podcast. We thought it might be a good idea to have some T-shirts. It's a very podcasty thing. But then, given the podcast that we are, we started thinking about the sustainability of the T-shirts and the provenance of the materials and the labour that said T-shirts were being made with. And that is sort of, we've got one foot down a rabbit hole. Is that a fair characterisation, Rinky?
Oh, no. I'm like head down and then my tippy toes are like peeking out of the rabbit hole at this point. When I entered the conversation and Tennant had designed up all these T-shirts, and I was like, have we talked much about the sustainability agenda? I'm like, yes, we looked. Are we going to name, like, platforms in these little T-shirt corner chats, or should we not do that at this stage?
There are widely used platforms for getting custom T-shirts made to order, and you, dear listener, know them. And until they pay us money, we're not going to mention their names.
Their sustainability credentials aren't such that we would use their services, but by all means, we'll advertise.
Well, look, at this stage, I don't feel like I'm on strong ground to say that their sustainability services are particularly, or credentials are particularly good or particularly bad. And that is why we are 18 minutes into this podcast and we're not yet at the report.
Can we cut to the chase?
Sorry, yes. Okay, so since the agenda of creating a couple of fun T-shirts came onto the scene, I have volunteered to take on the task of due diligence. And top of mind for me are not just, I think, the key environmental concerns. So when we're talking about, like, production of clothing, so, you know, where is that? What material would you want them made from? How do we track the provenance of that? And there are a couple of relevant standards to look at. So there's the Global Organic Textile Standard, which is sort of broadly viewed as best in class. There are other standards like OECOTEX, which sort of certify that there are, like, no nasties, so a range of other substances that you don't want presumably all over your body in clothing that you wear. as well as so not just the environmental side and that sort of part of the supply chain perspective, but also how much energy goes into not just the production of the, you know, the fabric, but the weaving of it, the transportation of it. So there's a whole supply chain piece to consider there. But also really importantly, the social side of the coin as well, which goes to, you know, where the people that, I'm just choosing cotton as an example, were they paid fair wages for their work? How do you ensure that end-to-end for the product, so not just the, you know, planting or, you know, harvesting the material, but the people responsible for sewing or assembling the garment. And there are different certifications you can look at for that, which in my spare time I have geeked out on in the past. And in this podcast, from time to time, in the next little while, I plan to update you on conversations I've had with various experts and friends of mine who do this stuff for a job. So you can look forward to more sustainable t-shirt-related trivia in the coming weeks and months, and maybe we'll end up with some t-shirts out of it at the end. Who's to say? It's too early to tell.
Who's to say? It sounds like a new corner, but so I think we need a corner name. T-shirt corner doesn't really cut it. Clothing provenance corner.
Shirt fronting with Frankie.
That fits me perfectly.
Very, very accurate. Frankie could spring at any moment into a previously scheduled segment to update us on her latest research on these nascent T-shirt enterprises.
It'll be worth it, I promise.
Can we please chat about a report?
Yay! Reports!
Unlocking investment in innovative climate solutions is crucial, but it is easier said than done. Investors need something to invest in, and with the exception of renewables, climate-aligned investment opportunities are uncommon in Australia, especially when compared with our global competitors. That's according to a new report from the Investor Group on Climate Change, Driving Australian Climate Innovation, Unlocking Capital to Support a Clean Industrial Revolution. In it, the IGCC compare Australia with five jurisdictions they say are doing a better job of mobilising capital for climate investment and consider what we could do differently here at home to emulate their success. Tennant, this is an interesting lens into a set of issues we discuss regularly on the pod. What did you make of it?
So, the Investor Group on Climate Change and sort of Uber consultancy investment facilitation super team firm Pollination have produced a set of recommendations for, you know, how can we be a place where not just emissions come down, I mean, that's very important, but also where economic stuff about the success and opportunity side of transition happens, where we're not just a place that adopts stuff and follows, but where there is pioneering going on and companies and industries being created that are going to help build the economic future of Australia in a net zero world. So that's all. Like, it's all very exciting and positive, but they paint a picture that's, I think, not that dissimilar to the one we saw in the IEA's assessment of the innovation and industry development scene in Australia in a previous episode.
This is almost the perfect segue into that conversation.
Yeah. Here's what you do. So, yeah, they've taken a look at Germany and South Korea and California and Denmark and the Netherlands and said these places are getting it right in some important senses at least. What are they doing? What can we learn? And what should Australia do next to be a place where innovation and investment leads to climate outcomes and economic outcomes. And the recommendations make a lot of sense. Does the methodology provide the strongest foundation for that those sensible recommendations?
So they tried to justify their choice of jurisdictions with a few metrics, which they thought spoke to a significant ecosystem of climate investment and activity. So there were four metrics: VC funding, as measured by the State of Climate Tech 2021 by Price Waterhouse Coopers. They looked at the shareholder value that had been created in various jurisdictions according to the S&P Global Clean Energy Index. They looked at demonstration projects, focusing in on one specific type of demonstration project, hydrogen demonstration projects, and they saw that as a relevant indicator for the propensity of particular jurisdictions to take early stage innovation and actually progress it to deployment. And the fourth metric they looked at was private sector patents within particular jurisdictions, because they felt that those private sector patents actually were representative of a propensity to actually take innovation and commercialise it, as opposed to pure research patents. So are they good metrics? I mean, they seem fine. I'm very conscious that they could have picked another four metrics and come up with a slightly different set of countries, but I didn't get too hung up on that, because I thought the five countries that they did focus on, Germany, Netherlands, South Korea, Denmark, and California, were perfectly reasonable ones to focus on, and there was enough of a cross-section there to generate some interesting discussion and analysis.
I sort of agree. I mean, the only it's a good set of countries, and I think that said, in terms of geographic variety, you know, three of the five are European. Might have been nice to see a little bit more variety outside of there. But equally, I think maybe I arced up about support for demonstration projects and zooming in just on green hydrogen, like that. It's kind of going to lend itself to places with particular geographical contexts and things like that. It's quite a specific kind of example to pick. But equally, you know, taken as a group, it's probably fine. I thought maybe when it's some of the rationale that resonated more strongly for me, in particular for countries like Germany, when you consider one of the main recommendations and I guess critiques that the report is making of the Australian context, is that we don't take enough risk on in terms of funding really early stage you know, innovation and development. And countries like Germany are, you know, rightly very well known for doing that, right? They're responsible. We've talked about this on this podcast for, in the early days, almost single-handedly growing the market for renewable energy like solar, putting huge amounts of money into that when other countries, you know, weren't as inclined. I don't know that there's much point dwelling on why they chose those particular countries, and then maybe focusing on, I guess, some of the recommendations that came through, because they're all relevant. And I don't know that we'd all disagree with any of the findings that they're putting forward.
So a very quick whip through of the recommendations, and then we can dig into each of them a bit more. They have major messages that we need a lot more focus than we have had on building markets and demand for low carbon products, not just pushing the supply, but having more market pull policies as well. The policies need to be more stable, supported, and coordinated. That we need a strong carbon constraints, Safeguard 2, IGCC and Pollination C as a start, but they want it to expand to cover more of the economy. They're calling for clearer sector transition and development plans that are part of broader industry planning and accompanied by evidence-based priorities that inform spending and incentives for innovation. They want, like getting very specific, they want to update the mandates of the Clean Energy Finance Corporation and the Australian Renewable Energy Agency so that they, those bodies can work on higher risk investments in priority sectors. And they want to improve the technology roadmap statements and boost resources for climate innovation through CSIRO and cooperative research centres. That's a lot. That's a lot of stuff. Broadly pretty sensible, but some of it much easier said than done.
Yeah, like it's absolutely sensible and a correct observation to say that Australia in the past has focused more on some of the push mechanisms or the supply of industries, and that's because we haven't had, you know, a lot of bipartisanship in the policy space to enact a lot of, you know, what would be classified as pull mechanisms, such as, you know, things like product standards or pricing carbon or, you know, tax incentives and things like that. So, like, I think context is everything for this. And it's good to see both of those things emphasised. I thought what was interesting in the, you know, I guess where they thought we needed to go from looking at both push and pull mechanisms was that idea about setting up broader industrial priorities. We sort of touched on that in our opening discussion. So, and it really, that implies like a whole of government approach, right, to sort of setting out a much more broad and high level vision for where we want to grow our industry into the future, and not just bringing to bear the kinds of policies that would create markets for products out of that, but how are you attracting human capital into those industries? Like, how are you making Australia a destination for smart people who can go about, you know, enacting and bringing those priorities to life? You know, a place that people want to be, as well as all the other things that you would think of when you're thinking about push mechanisms, like funding research and prototyping and doing pilots and things like that.
So I want to propose something that might be slightly controversial, which is that the recommendations in this report, while incredibly sensible and well thought through and kind of, you know, they hold together as an integrated set of asks, are not the most interesting bit of this report. Because I think the most interesting bit of this report is kind of trying to step a reader that is not of the finance sector, you know, is not particularly familiar with the prerogatives and priorities of institutional investors, through that mindset, trying to put you in their shoes and how they see the world. And there's this phrase that I think they seek to problematize a little bit, unlocking capital, right? The, you know, this gets thrown around all the time. It's like, oh, we just need investors to invest, right?
Yeah.
And the point that they're making is that it's all very well to say, well, investors need to invest, but institutional investors have responsibilities to their shareholders. If you're a super fund, you actually have legislated responsibilities not to invest in things that are going to underperform the market as a whole. Like, that is your goal, right? And so the point that they're making is, well, yes, we're interested in the transition. We're interested in supporting it. We're interested in allocating capital to it, but there actually has to be things to be invested in. And in Australia, they say in this report, there's a lot less sort of climate-related stuff, and particularly pure play exposure, which is where there's a company that that is primarily focused on, you know, a transition industry or a technology that's going to support the transition rather than it being bundled up in a much broader sort of array of business activities, there's just less of it. Hmm. And so if you're an Australian investor that wants to support the climate transition, you go and invest in other parts of the world because there just aren't those opportunities locally. And that's kind of the founding kind of insight of this report. And then they say, well, why is that? And then they start to look at the ecosystem for innovation in Australia. They start to compare particularly the very early stage R&D and the lack of public investment in that space in Australia relative to some of our competitors. And they do a deep dive on these five countries. But as we learnt from the IEA's country review last episode, like, you know, Australia's really in a woeful position when it comes to our R&D, particularly on energy, but this report says more broadly on climate-related technology. And then when you move beyond that sort of R&D space, it's like, well, who's demanding this technology? And in the absence of policy, there's no customer. Who's going to buy it? And, like, they're saying, well, yes, we want to invest, but we can't invest in businesses for whom there is no customer. Yes. So, yes, it's stable policy. Yes, it's about incentives and aligning, you know, in sort of an industrial strategy and this whole ecosystem that needs to be created. I think the really interesting insight from this paper is, like, yes, we can invest, but we need government on the field defining the market and the task that we have before us, because that will create the environment, the enabling environment in which we have businesses that we can invest in because we have confidence they'll be profitable.
And they could even have been a little more direct about it, yeah, in that message, because we've had a lot of discussion over recent years of how cheap variable renewable energy is getting, and, you know, it's the cheapest new source of megawatt hours if you don't particularly mind when the megawatt hours come. And, you know, some people saying, at this point, the electricity transition just kind of takes care of itself. The economic logic is going to drive it. It's fine. And investors can just get in there. Now, electricity is more complicated than that. But it's certainly the case that other parts of the transition are not there. Policy needs to put its thumb or its elbow or, you know, a bunch of policymakers all standing on top of the scales to get some technologies and solutions into mass deployment and something that is investable. And it's also the case that renewable energy got to where it is through past policies here and overseas that put their weight on the scale in that way. Locally, most notably, the renewable energy target, which was for most of its existence was bipartisan, was, you know, ultimately very big, and was very specific in creating the guaranteed market for a whole bunch of, at the time, expected to be fairly expensive renewables that turned out to be, you know, with collective efforts around the world, a lot cheaper in the end than was thought. So there is no license to lose money for investors. It can be a bit annoying, I guess, for the rest of us who aren't managing hundreds of billions of dollars to be told that they can't afford to do things. But they really can't. Like, that's people's pension money that they're playing with. And we absolutely, as you said, like, they need to be able to expect, businesses that are going to do transition stuff need to be able to expect that you can do transition and make a buck. And policy is inextricably a big part of making that situation come about. But how much risk can you take away before you've taken away too much risk? Do you overcommit to a technology or a company?
Which is where I guess these guys are trying to aim the thrust of their comments and recommendations, because part of the reason for reflecting a little bit on the experience in some of those other countries, and they say this, is that those countries in, you know, whether it's the Netherlands fostering of a, you know, wind industry there, you know, or you know, or Germany, kind of looking at its, you know, broad-scale industrial transition, they've created this ecosystem that effectively crowds in private investment. It doesn't crowd it out. And I think that is sort of going to your point, Tennant, and perhaps where some of the domestic critiques have been around where some government intervention, you know, has been had around investment in big lumpy infrastructure, you know, is that creating the landscape that's going to encourage more private investment, or is it crowding it out? So it's trying to take that much sort of broader view, and to your point, Luke, on creating that ecosystem, we're going to see markets for, you know, products out of these new industries with longevity and policy certainty around that. And I think government's role in fostering that much more clearly defined.
And I think the good news out of this report is that the argument is that if government does some of that early stage work, creates some of those pull factors, institutional investors stand ready to pour billions and billions of dollars into this transition like they want to. It's just that there is some sort of fundamental building blocks that are yet to be created, and they're able to point to other countries where that is indeed what has occurred. This isn't some kind of speculative fiction. This is something which has been achieved in some countries that, you know, are diverse, but they have share some characteristics with Australia. So I think it's an interesting sort of philosophical framework for some of the work that particularly Treasurer Jim Chalmers has been doing with his investment roundtable, where he has been getting together the banks and the super funds and the insurers and so forth, and talking about the frameworks that the government can create to encourage capital into the market, which is sometimes commented on as a bit of a flight of fancy, right? But there's actually, you know, there is some logic to it, and the logic is, I think, laid out in this paper, right?
If you create the conditions where it's going to be profitable and administratively, regulatorily possible to scale a clean activity, then there is a lot of money out there that will take it to the next step. I think that is reasonable, but the things that, among the things that stand in the way, is fear of getting it wrong in terms of picking the wrong priority. And actually, most of the things that are occurring to me are different forms of fearing of getting it wrong, because we've got a really difficult attitude towards risk taking in public policy. And we, the larger we, Australians, government people, media people, stakeholders of all descriptions, are going to need to work out some difficult stuff within ourselves in the attitudes to this. Because I could point to some of these, three of these economies that are things have not worked out in some aspects how they wanted them to. Like Germany put a hell of a lot of effort and market pull policy into developing a solar industry, and they got decimated because China did it better and bigger. And Korea has made a big coordinated policy and industry push on hydrogen mobility and hydrogen cars, except in the literal sense, not going anywhere. does that mean that they never should have made those calls in the first place? I would say actually it's better to have a go.
Because as we know, Tennant, if you have a go, you get a go.
It's an eternal line that will never get old, unlike me. You do have to make some attempts to get anywhere, and we could talk about like the fear of backing individual industries or companies that go awry I mean, you need propriety in things, but of course you need to back a portfolio of opportunities and in the knowledge that some of them are going to fail.
Mm.
And like the classic example in this context is probably the Obama administration era American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. I think that was what ARRA stood for, which included honking big loan guarantees for clean tech prospect companies. And there was a solar one, Solyndra, that famously didn't pan out. But there was a little electromobility company called Tesla that did work out. And if I had one Tesla and one Solyndra and a bunch of companies that nobody can remember the name of in my portfolio, I would say I was an epic genius. But geez, that was a successful program, except politically it was disastrous and was a byword for failure for years after.
I don't think we should underestimate the challenge in shifting that mindset in the Australian context and you know, reflect on why that is. I mean, again, it goes back to that the fact that we haven't had bipartisanship in this country around the broad thrust of of this transition, and hence there's been this report is characterising as pretty risk-averse stance when it comes to funding R&D comparatively with some of those other countries. And so we need to, I think, very quickly have a bit of a reset on this, because I remember this being a big reflection point, Luke, when we were in Germany last year, asking about some of the German policymakers, how they used all the data from their the $20 billion a year they spent to incentivize building homes to higher standards. Like, that must create some really good data for your cost benefit analysis to make that stack up. And like, we don't do cost benefit analysis. There's a sort of bipartisan and broadly agreed imperative that we need to move on, you know, on these issues, and it requires a significant quantum of funding put towards it. And so they don't get tied up in knots over the cost benefit, you know, on a particular policy intervention. And that's just not where Australia's at right now. So this is really, like, it would be nice to sort of see that much more elevated out of here, to say that that's sort of really where the mindset shift needs to go. And I think they sort of frame that in the recommendations a bit more around the mandate of existing bodies like the CEFC and ARENA. But really, it should apply much more broadly across the way that government funds R&D and you know, perhaps set some of those broader signals around industry development priorities.
I think it's a balancing act, right? Because there's always going to be finite resources, and so you're always going to have to make choices. And I guess it's how big your field of choices are, and the degree to which you have the ability to place. That range of small bets, and the focus particularly on early stage public interest R&D suggests you're not necessarily pouring huge amounts of money into everything at the outset. You're actually just trying to till your field, you know, see what turns up, see what grows, and see what is appropriate to back in further. The thing that was most vexing from this paper, which was saying a lot of this is enabled by bipartisanship.
Yes.
Right. A lot of it is enabled by, you know, the major parties within a particular political ecosystem are broadly aligned on the task at hand. They may have differences in exactly how to get there, but there is an iterative process going on over time. Mm. And the task before us in terms of economic transition is so great that if you are ripping up the roadmap every 10 years or so and starting again, you're unlikely to get very far, which is almost a truism. It's all just silly to say, like, you know, we've probably said it, you know, 50 times on the podcast over the last year. But again, going back to the institutional investor view, like, they're thinking about, well, where can I make a reasonable return for my shareholders, for the folk whose funds I am the steward of? If you don't have confidence that there's going to be a durable business model for a reasonable amount of time, because, you know, there's every prospect that it could be a government in 6 or 9 years that just has a completely different vision of where they want to take the country, that is an element you have to take into account when you're making those investments. They don't use the exact phrase, but there's this idea in there of fostering an environment in which capital is happy to be patient, and, you know, is allowed to sit there while companies develop, while business models develop. And I think that one of the other things we're sort of bouncing around, back and forward, ping-ponging between visions of, you know, a economic future, means that there's much less propensity to take on the risk of just placing a long bet, which is really, really problematic. But I don't know how one solves that. Yes, bipartisanship. Hooray.
We'll just say bipartisanship some more.
And that's not the investor group and climate change's fault. It's like, it's a good point to make, but, like, what does one do about that?
Well, there's like two pathways to policy stability that you could divine from the countries and economies that they look at. And they both could be taken in the Australian context as, like, maybe pathways that people could consider. So you've got broadly, like, the European pathway and the Californian pathway. The European pathway is that the major parties do some form of setting the ground rules, broad directional deal. They accept broad parameters of policy, and they have, you know, little arguments about emphases and implementation and that sort of things, and maybe some, like, extreme alternative radical weirdos outside the centrist consensus chuck some literal and figurative rocks at it, but broadly policy is quite similar over time. And so the Australian implication would be that the major parties just have a talk and come up with some parameters. The Californian pathway is that one side of politics runs itself into a ditch and stays there with the engine revving and smoke coming out of it for decades, and the other side has super majorities and does whatever it can agree within itself to do until such time as there's competitive politics again. And, you know, that could be an option in Australia too. It's not a great one. You know, having viable multi-party politics is quite a good thing. And having all the political choices be inside one, you know, in the primaries and the internal workings of one party, it's not super attractive, but I guess you make your cake with the ingredients you've got to hand. So what's it going to be?
Well, yeah, and we do have examples in the Australian context where a degree of consensus has been achieved. We've talked a little bit recently about what the previous government was able to achieve in New South Wales in terms of, you know, very strong support across party lines in the parliament for some of the significant energy and climate reforms that were prosecuted over the last 2 or 3 years, prosecuted by a Liberal government. You know, that is a thing that has been done in very recent history. And so we shouldn't despair of the prospect of that. But it is so fundamental that it is certainly something we should be reflecting on, about what the Australian version of that pathway might look like at a national level, because it's crucial.
And we do have consensus and continuity within broad parameters in other areas of national public policy. Nobody goes to an election thinking that, you know, the army might get abolished afterwards, or that nobody thinks anymore that Medicare will simply vanish in a puff of party platform. But at one point, Medicare was not part of a broad consensus. Mm-hmm. So, you know, things can change. But to the point, if this one doesn't change, if the positioning of climate transition doesn't change, we are not going to see a heck of a lot of that patient capital invested.
I want to be the optimist in this conversation a little bit.
It's a low bar.
I know. And suggest, I think, by the time this is a question for the Australian electorate again, I just think we've moved on from the should we or shouldn't we be doing the transition. And I don't know that that's where the next argument's going to be. It may well be around which set of priorities the government is going to pursue. But I would hope that we're actually past the big hump of this debate in the country. Like, we've the previous government did sign up to a net zero by 2050 target, and that side of politics is to be in government again. They're going to need policies, you know, that will deliver that, and did put in place some of the, you know, some elements that are touched on in this report, actually, around the technology roadmap statement. So I think there's ways of framing this challenge around setting industrial priorities and the evolution of technology that could see us on ground that's more likely to encourage bipartisanship rather than focusing on some other elements of the debate. And I think also we've reflected on in this podcast as well is that patient capital will also look at the kind of underlying fundamentals in a market as well. And we are talking about people's pension funds, hence why it's absolutely the right word to refer to it as patient. We are talking about investing on decades-long horizons here. And so some of the opportunities are very attractive from an investment perspective. And if you can get the conversation to a point where it's, you know, it's probably more framed around economic opportunity, I think we'll be on surer footing. I want to be that optimist in this conversation. I don't think we're revisiting the climate wars of the past anymore.
I think that's a very attractive vision. I just see some evidence that some people find the ditch more attractive, and they're revving in the ditch with four wheels in the air, and maybe that's a pathway to something too for everybody else.
All right, it is time for One More Thing, in which we all share something that is currently captivating our attention. Frankie, what have you got?
Well, and a sign that I am as, if not more, discombobulated than I felt in the last couple of weeks. I actually spent some time in the lead up to this recording reading another IGCC report that I thought we'd agreed to discuss on the pod, but in fact had not. And so I got two IGCC reports for the price of one in this pod. And
the low, low price of about a day of reading.
That's right. So I've read also in recent times The State of Net Zero Investment, and it was super interesting read. It was a summary of a survey that IGCC did with their institutional investor base. I think it was about just over 50 combination of asset owners and asset managers with an average of about 25 billion assets under management each. So, you know, an enormous amount of investment covering about 60% of sort of all assets under management in Australia. So very representative survey. And, you know, there were some really good takeouts. I think showed that, you know, most investors have now made, like, in the order of 70% have made public targets for net zero emissions by 2050. Far less have set interim targets. That's a comprises a much smaller proportion of commitments, but it's growing really quickly. I think the momentum in the last couple of years, I think, was one of the big standouts in reading the report. So you're seeing this kind of growth of commitments that go beyond the long term and looking much more at sort of interim targets, as well as actually what we touched on in this pod today, which was around more commitments around climate solutions investments. So the idea we were talking about opportunities for sort of pure play investments in, you know, a clean energy transition, you know, not being where they are, say, in other jurisdictions. There's a growing, I think, amount of investors who are wanting to set targets for those kinds of investments, and that's increasing, but there's a lack of opportunity so far. So anyway, lots of really great insights. And like the point we were making on the other report we've just been talking about, if you want to familiarise yourself with you know, more of a perspective of the investment community, I think this is a really great also report to read. It's pretty authoritative in terms of the spread of investors it represents. So, yeah, some really useful insights. Can recommend. Thanks, IGCC, for filling up my weekend reading dance card.
Is your new corner going to be IGCC Report Corner?
If they sponsor this podcast, sure. Come see us with your
billions and billions of dollars.
Assets under management. Do you need another asset under management?
Do I have a pure play opportunity for you?
Indeed. Oh.
Yes, but what's the business model of this podcast?
Well, a burgeoning t-shirt empire, obviously.
I think the supply chain, the productive capacity of t-shirts of this podcast is yet to be demonstrated.
Oh,
there's problems in the early stage innovation pipeline.
That's because nobody's funding my time to look into it. So, hello, IGCC, come at me. Got a minute. I'm really glad we made this full circle back to the t-shirts.
Tennant, what have you got?
So I want to note the release of the draft Mandatory Gas Industry Code of Conduct, an important bit of energy policy. I was hideously, protractedly, endlessly involved in the voluntary gas industry code of conduct development.
Oh, we heard about it.
You did. And unlike that, this one is capable of doing something. And the key things to keep in mind about this mandatory gas industry code of conduct, it has a bunch of provisions around fair conduct in the negotiation of wholesale gas supply agreements between large buyers and large sellers. That is something that actually everybody has a stake in, because some of those large buyers are retailers, and the contracts will ultimately flow through to the gas that's bought to heat homes and cook dinner and heat water. But the more controversial part of it is the reasonable pricing provision, and in this draft, the reasonable pricing process is much simpler than it sounded like it was going to be in the earlier versions of this. Basically, the emergency $12 gas price cap is going to continue for a couple of years. Then there'll be a review of whether it's still needed, and if so, what level it should be set at. The ACCC will set that price cap, and there's a bunch of exemptions from the price cap, basically for small locally oriented gas producers or large ones who make binding court enforceable commitments to supply gas. And what's the result of it going to be? Look, I think for as long as the global tight gas market lasts, there's going to be an intervention in place that tries to restrain, probably succeeds in restraining broadly available gas prices to $12 a gigajoule-ish. And then a very open question, whether that system just sort of evaporates with the rebalancing of international gas markets, or whether we continue with a system that seeks to permanently separate local gas price setting from international prices. And it seems like the government's heart may be more in the latter, and maybe the bureaucracy's heart more in the former, but it's not going to be definitively known for at least 2 and a bit years.
Okay.
I'm restraining myself from saying more about the mandatory gas code, and everyone is the winner from that restraint.
Well, we will watch that with interest. For my one more thing, I want to point you to the excellent What Matters pod, and particularly the most recent one, co-hosted along with some other luminaries by friend of the pod, Jan Rosenau, who happens to be joining us in Australia at the National Energy Efficiency Conference in a couple of weeks. But I'm particularly interested in pointing you to this episode because the most recent episode features another friend of the pod, Thomas Novak, who is Secretary General of the European Heat Pump Association. And they dig into what's been going on with heat pumps over the last couple of years in Europe, which has been quite extraordinary. Incredibly significant growth in the deployment of heat pumps, the manufacture of heat pumps. It was already growing, but that effort has been supercharged, obviously, by the added imperative to get off Russian gas. So super fun sort of analysis of what's been going on over there, but also really interesting discussion and indeed debate of the European Union's F-gas directive, which has been around for a while, but there's recent moves to increase the rate of the phase-out of fluorinated greenhouse gases, which are very global warming intensive gases, because there are still heat pumps on the market, many sort of being manufactured at scale that use F-gases. There is this kind of competing priority. The European Union says on the one hand they want to phase out these gases more quickly, but they also say they want to get heat pumps out in the market post-haste. These two imperatives are crashing into each other. So there's a really interesting discussion on the podcast with two pretty divergent views about, you know, the relative priority of these various goals. So that's a fun discussion and something that we should all be thinking about.
The Captain America Civil War of heat pump discussions.
I should hasten to add, it's not Jan that is having the debate with Thomas. It's one of his colleagues. But anyway, worth a listen. I think that's a pod, team, unless you've got any other interventions, Frankie, any other nascent businesses you want to share with our audience.
I didn't start the T-shirt things with you guys. I've just been roped into...
Well, yeah. Roped in?
No, sorry.
Roped in boots and all.
I think you tied the rope around your belt and jump down that rabbit hole.
You're firing the T-shirt cannon now.
Glutton for punishment.
All right. Well, that is our show for today. We're all on Twitter, such as it is. Frankie is at...
Frankie Muscovich.
Tennant is at...
Tennant Reed.
My handle is at Luke Menzel. We have an email address. Frankie, what should folk be doing with it?
Oh, you should be firing in their suggestions for papers, preferably less than 100 pages. 50 is a sweet spot for us right now. Any 50-page spectaculars, send them on through to us at mailbag@letmesumup.net, as well as, you know, any other hot takes on this pod or others in our back catalogue you feel the need to share, including thoughts... Oh, that was the other thing. Yes, no, I do have another intervention, but it's also related to T-shirts. The shout-out was, that I meant to say, As I'm like doing this deep dive and talking to, you know, fabulously smart people about these things, if you're one of those people and you have advice for us on the sustainable procurement of T-shirts, I want to hear from you. So flick those emails through to mailbag@letmesumup.net. Okay, that really is all. Okay, thanks, bye.
Elegantly done. And Tennant, you have a website. What's there?
At letmesumup.net, you will discover all the back episodes of this fine podcast that your heart could desire. So go there and soak in the magnificence of the reports that have been, and think of the reports that are yet to be.
I endorse this message. For Frankie Muskovich and Tennant Reid, I'm Luke Menzel. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you again soon.